Welcome to Happy Path Programming. I'm Bruce Eckel.
I'm James Ward.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us for Happy Path Programming. I think this is probably our last one of 2023.
Unless you line something up for next Friday.
It's possible. Yeah, possible.
No. Maybe. You saved the best for last.
That's right. We have saved the best for last. So Sushila is our guest today, and we'll introduce you in a second, but we have to talk about Winter Tech Forum first.
Yes. All indications are it's May 26th. February 26th through March 1st. The contract hasn't been inked for the space yet, but the guy said, okay, I'm going to put it on the calendar. So, yeah.
And this is our in-person get-together in Crested Butte, where Bruce and I live. Yep. Come and ski and hang out with nerds. Mm-hmm. And
it's always an awesome time. It always seems like we're having a lot of fun. And yet somehow amidst that, the tech conversations just fly.
Yeah.
You know, and people come away going, not only am I relaxed, but I learned way more than I would in a normal conference or a seminar or whatever. So we're all amazed by how much we learned by doing this. So if you go to the website, wintertechforum.com, the dates aren't there yet because I'm just, you know, waiting for the final ink to dry. Yeah. But that sure looks like that's when it's going to be. So try and keep that open on your calendar.
Nice. Great. Yep. And I'm starting to think about what hackathon project I'll be working on. Maybe I got to get the Easy Racer stuff done. So maybe I'll try to get that wrapped up.
I got the impression that would never be done.
Maybe it will never be done. So maybe I'll just have to make some progress on it.
Yeah.
And that's the structured concurrency compared against across a bunch of different languages and frameworks and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, cool. Which we did a hackathon on last year at the Winter Tech Forum. So, okay, on to our regularly scheduled guest. So, Sushila, thanks for joining us. I wanted to have you on because you are the best manager I've ever had. And I don't think any of my other managers or current manager listens to the podcast. So hopefully I'm not offending anyone. But I really enjoyed working for you. This was now like 10 years ago at TypeSafe, now known as Lightbend. Mm-hmm. And welcome. Maybe just give us a little bit of introduction about you and what you're up to now. And then we'll get into it.
Sure. I'm so happy to be here. And it's always such a pleasure to engage with you guys. And, you know, we work in the same technology field, but in such different capacities. And I love just hearing about what's going on in your world, sharing what's going on in my world, and finding all those nuggets of sameness, despite that we're really, you know, you're in the nerdy world and I'm in the business annoying world. And yet we have such a great relationship. Our working relationship was fantastic. Our friendship is so meaningful. So yeah, I'm just really happy to be here. Oh. And yeah, gosh, you know, just so the audience knows, I've had decades and decades and another decade almost in technology. Primarily solely on the business side, primarily running operations and post sales, customer success groups, services, support, customer success, account management. I have also broadened my operations experience to cover things like HR, finance, legal. So I bring what I think is a pretty comprehensive view around the business and people. And my whole philosophy is do whatever it takes to make people successful, and that will make a company successful.
I'm glad you went there, because that was actually going to be my first question. Is like, you've managed nerds for a long time, and including me for about a year and a half, which was amazing. But I was curious if you had like a philosophy of management that you've brought to how you manage people and maybe specifically nerds. And you just mentioned it, which was making people. The people that work for you successful? Was that the right?
Yeah, that's really the crux of it. I think one of the ways that I really do that is I try to learn what our conceptual challenges that the people who work for me might experience. And I really try to share what are the objectives of the company, of the role, of the team, of their individual contribution, so that we can all align. And then I trust their expertise and I help them when they need it. But I really believe that people can bring unique value. And as a leader, as a manager, it's our job to just foster that in a way that aligns with the overall company success or team success.
Yeah. But that requires that you not be threatened by people underneath you having success.
Correct.
And that is like a whole path for a lot of people in management to go through to get to that point. You know, that's like life work that they may never achieve in a lifetime to get that level of confidence.
It's funny. I think it's in large part because I don't care if I'm right. I care if we do the right thing. I'm very outcome focused versus Sushila focused. And I don't know, maybe that's from being the youngest person. Maybe that's because I feel like if I'm focused on, when I said youngest person, I meant on a leadership team or in my family. I was the baby in my family. So whenever everyone else around me is doing well, like I'm just propped up that, like, and I feel really good about it. I think it's been interesting being a woman in technology because you naturally feel threatened because, you know, leadership roles aren't as common. And so you have to fight a lot for them. And very early on, I started realizing like, I'm probably not going to win by competing head to head with a bunch of people. So if I just make a bunch of people successful, that's just going to naturally lead me to more and greater opportunities. And that's how I've managed my career. And now I'm the global VP of a public company that does $600+ million in revenue. And I run a team of over 100 people. And, you know, and I feel like, okay, that was the right approach to take. I also felt like it was very rewarding to go down that path. So if I made a sacrifice here and there where I could have maybe taken a next role by being more cutthroat and, you know, recognizing threats around me, well, who wants to operate like that? I don't. I like to have fun at work. I like to be happy at work. I don't want to have a lot of contention and negative relationships in my life. And work is a big part of my life. So I just kind of trust that it's all going to work out.
But it sounds like you kind of grew up in a particular way. I mean, it sounds like you naturally went down that path. You know, that's who you are now.
Sure. What,
can we train existing people to be like that? Or do we have to just select?
You just get an MBA and then that's solved. That's it. That's
Right. Exactly. Because to me, it sounds like, oh, I mean, you have to select people who are already that way. I don't think, unless you put them through massive amounts of therapy, it would take years to get to the point where they go, oh, yeah, I'm not threatened by the success of people underneath me. So, of course, and I know what it feels like to help people be successful and that supports me rather than threatens me. I mean, that's such a fundamental description of who a person is.
Sure.
I think you have to select.
How do you create that?
I don't know that. I mean, because
Here's something that I think is important to help people evolve that way. And let's not pretend I'm not hugely competitive. I am. And I want to win. And you know, those are natural qualities
but
I
not
have.
You don't want to win versus the people who are working for you. That's the thing.
Exactly. And, you know, when I first had my Silicon Valley experience decades ago, I was the right hand to the COO of a company. We were doing so freaking well. We went public. We were the darlings of Silicon Valley. And then things, you know, started, bubbles started bursting around us. And you see leaders in action when times are good and when times are tough. And all you have to do is observe and see what are they doing that's working and not working. And I would see a lot of people getting really micromanagey, which means like not trusting the folks below you, really dictating, like, you must do this, you must do that, you must achieve this, you must achieve that. And the whole culture became slightly toxic. And the trust in that leader just like dissolves by all the people that are working for them. And everything starts going wrong. Like, it's bad enough that the macro environment is not supporting your business goals, but now your team is just not motivated to achieve. You know, everyone just feels shitty all the time. And that is a very unhealthy, unhappy environment. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to create it. And so I started realizing, wow, as a manager, as a leader, an executive, whatever, you have so much influence around all of these things. And if you just try to keep people engaged, motivated, focused, enthusiastic, and successful, it's so much easier to get things done. It's so much more likely that you're going to get things done. And I just learned that by observing. So sure, I have some natural qualities for it, but I also thought very specifically, what kind of leader do I want to be? And what kind of leader don't I want to be? And I've seen people mature as leaders and get to a point where they realize, as your scope widens, especially, and your influence becomes more necessary, there's no way you can know it all. There's no way you can do it all. So you have to build an environment where you trust people and they like working for you and they're motivated by your philosophy and they feel engaged and responsible for their own success and your success.
I'm going to push back a little. Sure. On what you said, you go, oh, all I do is observe what other people do and works right. Now, I went through a period where I was going, okay, I'm going to solve this business management, whatever problem. And one of the things that I saw was there were all these leaders that would talk about why they were successful. And then you'd listen to the next one. And they'd say why they were successful. And then you go, wait a minute, that's diametrically opposed to what the previous person said. And you begin to realize how much delusion there is there. And that a lot of it, nobody wants to say, well, I was lucky. And a lot of things just came together. They want to say, oh, I have the formula for you. And you do this and this and this thing. And then when you actually look at the big picture, you're going, well, it's that none of those formulas seem to work.
Yeah.
And so when you observe and say, oh, this seems to work, I think there needs to be a filter there that says, this might be something that works.
I think that's an excellent point. I am wondering if you were calling me delusional, but we'll get to that later. However,
well, we all have our cognitive biases, so yeah, I guess we're all delusional.
But I guess I should have prefaced everything with, that's what works for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But what I'm saying is that you're doing something more than observing. You're like saying, you're observing and you're going, oh, and the people who are working in this company are like motivated and happy. And so those things that I'm seeing may be contributing to that.
Yeah.
And that's what you're looking for without even maybe noticing it.
It's a good point. And I, you know, observing is one thing, incorporating is another, right? And so you have to figure out like, okay, if that's working for that person and that's what I see, how what do I do with that? How do I embrace it, demonstrate it? Can I still be authentic and true to myself using what I see working for someone else? So it isn't as easy as just observing.
And what you just said, authentic and true to myself. Now, I would argue that most managers are not necessarily incorporating that idea.
Right.
But it's just part of your background. It's part of the water that you swim in.
Yeah.
So you don't even think about that. You just go, well, of course, it's got to be authentic and true to myself.
Right. You know, in part because I like, and this sounds weird, but I like to take the path of least resistance. I'm not someone who loves friction and chaos and drama, which is part of why I really love focusing on operations, because really what you're trying to do is take friction out of a system and make things as easy as possible. And I think the easier you can make things, the less stressful, all of that, the better. So, you know, how that translates to how I specifically manage people is like, I give very clear objectives, I set expectations, I hold people to timelines so that we can all just be productive around a system. And I think a lot of leaders don't think that way. They just think, I'm going to hire a bunch of bright people and they're going to do a bunch of good things. And then I'm going to tell them, like, make sure you hit a deadline and that's it. And they don't, then they're upset that things went wrong or someone didn't perform or, you know, someone thought they were doing great. And meanwhile, nothing that you expected actually happened. So you have to be very clear about expectations and people love that. But where was I going with all of this?
I wanted to actually hop back for a second, which is, I think what Bruce was pointing out was that as you figured out your management philosophy, there was some combination of who Sushila is as a wonderful human combined with your curiosity and desire to learn and understand how something can work with less friction. Right. And those two things combined is what I think has made you such an amazing manager. I think where initially what Bruce was pointing out is that we can't ignore the fact that Sushila is an amazing human. And that's kind of this like foundation of you being able to learn the like management aspect that worked well.
Well, And thank you for all the positive feedback. I'm someone who loves applause and I love compliments and I'm not going to pretend I don't. I was a singer growing up and being on stage, just, you know, and getting applause, it fed my soul. So I really appreciate all your comments. I also strive to be a decent human being in everything I do. And going back to your point, Bruce, about, or your question about authenticity, and my response around path of least resistance and taking friction out of a system. When I was first in technology as a woman, you know, I saw that there was an opportunity to try to be just like all the guys I was working with. I was often the only woman in the room, the only executive woman. And so, you know, you thought about like, let me tamp down my feminine qualities and just be like one of the guys. And I have a lot of amazing male friends and male relationships in my life. But we don't
need more male energy. We have enough.
Right. But this was decades ago where conversation about male energy. The only way you were going to get ahead was by demonstrating a lot of male energy.
Yep.
And I'm not going to say I don't have male energy, but what I realized was I'm not just one of the guys. So why not figure out these things that make me unique, that give me a different perspective in a boardroom or in a meeting, and double down on those qualities? Otherwise, you are just going head to head, competing, and, you know, unlikely to win.
the value of diversity is not taking people in and making them like more white men. It's what you bring, the perspectives that you bring that the rest of the room doesn't know about. And that's why companies make more money if they're more diverse. It's because they can reach, I think, is because they reach more markets, because they understand more markets.
Exactly. It's that simple. And again, though, these were things that I thought about that weren't really supported by companies' philosophies in general. But I felt like it was quite a privilege to be working at a level that was senior and be surrounded by a bunch of really smart people. But I also thought, and this is, you know, probably a product of growing up as a minority person in a very, what's the opposite of diverse? Homogeneous part of Canada. And so, you know, I'm different all the time. Like throughout my life, there's a difference. I'm either the only woman, I'm the only brown woman, I'm the shortest person in the room. Like you could go on and on about what makes you different, right? And so I just had a lot of confidence that being different could be valuable. And so I found
the life experiences that you had outside of the like tech
leadership realm. Which is partly the whole authenticity thing, right? You use your life experiences just to be a better person, to be a better leader, to be a better, to empathize more. And so that's part of why I think I can manage technical people and nerds and be married to one successfully. Is because
successfully, she had to add that.
Oh, these nerds, they're hard to get along with.
But it's because I try to embrace other people's experiences and recognize our differences and figure out how we can come together and bring those differences together to make the sum of the parts greater, whatever that. I don't know if I'm actually answering any of your questions.
No, that's fine. I do find sometimes, because early on I had a few awful jobs and I decided, oh, I never want to work for anybody because I don't want anybody to tell me what to do and all that.
Yeah.
But lately I've been wondering, you know, every once in a while in this exploration, I've come across a job that I go, oh, that would actually be, you know, not too bad. That would have been maybe pretty pleasant. And I, you know, if I was working for somebody like you, I'm wondering, how would, and James has had jobs that he's really enjoyed. And I'm going, maybe I was too, I'm almost certain I was too harsh. But I still think the number of jobs that would have worked for me is just such a small fraction.
Right. And it's good to recognize that, right? Oh, yeah. You know, I hate being told what to do. I hate it. I absolutely hate it.
Is there anybody that likes it?
I think some people do actually want to know, like, I mean, I do a lot of mentoring and helping people early in their career. And a lot of people say, like, tell me what to do to get to the next step. Tell me what to do to get to your level. And I'm like, that you have to change your mindset, because no one's going to tell you what to do. You have to find a way to find the opportunities to bring the value and solve the big problems. And no one is going to come to you and tell you, James, solve this problem early in your career.
That's funny you bring this up, because in mentoring some developer advocates in the past, some of them would ask the questions like, how do I move up the ranks as a developer advocate? And of course, there's always the set expectations and, you know, the structure that defines how you move up as in any role, especially in large companies. But the advice I would always give to these people is, like, ignore all of that. And what you need to do is something amazing that is not in that structure. And that's how you move up.
Be aware of the structure, but then go, okay, you know, ultimately it's doing something impressive that yeah. is what's going to do that
for yeah me. And like, then the hard question is, what is that amazing impressive thing that you can do?
Well, just
and that's
be
where
creative.
That's it, just be, and, that's it, it's
well
that simple.
And when you
it's...
then see the way I look at it is, well, you go through school and they go, okay, here's the homework, here's the test, it will tell you exactly what to do to progress, and you get into that mindset and
yes.
you go out into work and you go, well, it's going to be the same, right? And it can be. There's
maybe.
A lot of companies where it's like, yeah, we'll tell you what to do. You do it. We'll tell you everything.
Yeah.
And, but it is, yeah, it's a sad statement on our educational system that it turns people into, I mean, that's what it was intended yeah. to do. It was intended, I think, originally the British, you know, empire said, well, we need administrators for all of our empire components, and so that's what we're going to teach for and we're still and it's just like, yeah, here's the rules, you've got to follow the rules, and then you'll get, and so yeah.
And maybe there are job profiles where that does work, like maybe if you're an accountant or something that's more I don't know, there's not jobs. A lot of opportunity for creativity, whereas
apparently
jobs
with accounting there is.
That's a good point. We were talking about Enron this morning.
Yeah.
So
you can be, yeah, I always thought yeah, it's just putting numbers in columns, but then when you start learning more about accounting, you're going, oh, there's a lot of ways that they interpret things, and set it's
yeah.
it can be very creative.
My point with the whole I hate to be told what to do is that I don't, because of that, I don't tell people what to do.
And, because you know what it feels like.
Yeah. And if I have to tell you what to do, then you're probably not the right person for my team. And I'm probably not the right manager for you, because I speak in very, I speak about objectives. I don't tell you how to make a sausage. And, but I will help remove obstacles and challenges and help you problem solve, but I'm not going to tell you how to do something, because, you know, I brought you onto the team, or you're on my team because I think you are fully capable of figuring stuff out, bringing your own unique approach to something. And I love being empowered to just solve a problem. So I am going to empower you to solve a problem, unless you tell me you need instructions, in which case I'll say, okay, go talk to this person and go be on their team, because if that's what you need to do your best work, great, you can get it elsewhere, because I'm not
well
capable.
And I think one of the biggest problems that we have in especially tech companies is that people who are in management often like the control feeling of saying, oh, we will use this new language or this new technology, and they don't have the expertise to make that decision.
Oh, exactly.
And yet they want the feeling of power of making that decision.
Just rewrite it and go. Everything will be fine.
Oh, yeah, that's just the classic, the classic example. It's like, oh, we're switching everything to go, and you're just going, you don't even know what that means. Programming language aside, saying that you're going to take all of your software and rewrite it in another language, you have no clue the impact.
So I want to take a small tangent real quick just to point out that I think oftentimes when people share their management philosophy and this stuff, people that have worked for them can probably listen to that and be like, this person is just lying about everything. And I think it's really important to point out that I've experienced what you're saying with you, and it is actually true. And that is something amazing. So as an example to your being focused on objectives, I remember one of the best management experiences I had with you was around Scala days. I don't remember what year was that, 2015, 2014, 13. And you were very clear, we need 500 registrations in 2 months or something like that.
Yeah,
but
it was intense.
It was super intense. We were, for various reasons, we had a lot of pressure on this event. But what was cool about it is, back to what you're saying about establishing the objectives, you gave Laura and I and the rest of the team the freedom to figure out how we were going to achieve that. it was very clear what the objective it was. It seemed crazy, and we actually did achieve it. But I think we wouldn't have achieved it if you had instead said, you need to do this and this. And like, if you'd micromanaged the whole thing, we would have never gotten there. But yeah, we felt ownership over that objective and felt empowered to do what we needed to do to make that
autonomy,
happen.
Autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's a great example because it brought, if I remember correctly, and I'm pretty sure I do, because this was one of the most stressful things in my professional career, was having to put together this developer conference within 2 months, from finding a venue to marketing the whole thing to, you know, trying to ensure that it was going to be a valuable conference and to get people to pay for it. Like, oh my God. And then there's just all the events.
There was a lot of pressure. It was super stressful, super short timelines. And you it was all riding on you to make sure that that was all delivered, but you didn't like micromanage us in this.
I couldn't. There was, first of all, I can't, like, I'm not a micromanager. It's not something I enjoy, want to do. Like, I'm just not going to do it.
Well, and it's a huge waste of your energy.
And so to that point, I think one of the things that worked really well there is I got people with different skills and value to bring to this hard problem that we had to solve with a very specific outcome, and then allowed you guys, trusted you to figure it out, because you all would do something incredibly different and important to help achieve this goal. And so, James, you were reaching out to the community, getting the right speakers, and, you know, making it the content really meaningful for attendees. Laura was doing the newsletters and having the bringing the creative around the sponsorship program. And Jen was doing the operational tracking and registration database and all of that. And so there was no real overlap, but it meant bringing the right team together who could just execute on all the different things. And you all had my trust that you were going to do it. And oh my God, there was so much going wrong with every step of the way. So, you know, I had to be very involved, but not in your specific streams, work streams. Like, you guys were just doing it and making things happen. And the things that went wrong, I tried to fix. And it was such a good example of a diverse team just firing on all cylinders. And it was such a successful conference.
It was. It was amazing.
So here's a thing that comes to mind where it seems like a touch from management might be useful. When your team is making things too complicated, too hard.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, it's like what you want to do is start, get something working, and then evolve it. And when people are still in the mindset of, okay, we're going to, the first thing out of the gate is going to have all the features in it. It's going to do everything. And, and we're worried about all these little details that we can't even tell if they're going to be details until we get something working.
Yeah.
How do you, how would you like go, hey, let's take a step back and just look at our overall objective, which is to get this basic thing working and then see if it works, see where the problems are, and then add features to it. What would you do? And
this is where I think a lot of startup technology teams and the business side go very wrong, is they focus on that question instead of...
Which question?
How do we make this technology do X, Y, Z more efficiently? Or they make it a technology problem. And if you are actually trying to create a commercial business that provides technology, you have to start with who is going to use this to do what, and why would they pay for it? And if you have technology that, you know, how do we add features to it? How do we make this work? Da 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 da. You have to go back to these questions. Who are we building this for, to do what and why, and are they going to pay for it? Yeah. And you can't really ask the expert engineers to answer those questions. You need to talk to potential users. And most of the time, your potential users, at least the ones who are going to pay enough to cover the investment of these highly skilled people, they want something fast, easy, cheap, solves a problem. So you have to talk to them about their use case, what features they need, and you have to bring it back to the engineers. Mm. I think this is like my biggest learning in technology. And I think asking expert engineers to design a very simple solution for your average engineer who's working for a big company potentially and needs to just move fast and needs things to be simple and has no time to learn something new or shift a whole paradigm, you know, that's just not how big companies work. So you just can't ask the experts to make that leap. And if they can, that is a unicorn and that's fantastic. But by and large, it's really a challenge. And I think it sets up the team, the technical team, for failure.
Mm. Right. Well, in a sense, you're asking the technical people to also be marketers. If you're
exactly. And product managers.
And well, yes. Managers. Yes, exactly. And it would be like you asking me, you know, what's the best architecture for blah, blah. Mm. Like, I don't know. What?
How would you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Until you try it.
Yeah. Like ask me things that I can answer and I'll ask you things that you can answer and then we'll, you know, find the way to go forward.
So I want to, we have a time limit and I want to inject a different topic here because we were talking about this morning and thought you might have some insights on it. How do we make open source a viable, I mean, so much terrific stuff gets created by open source, so much better than what comes from inside of companies.
Yeah.
So how do we support that? Because so far, maybe our culture hasn't evolved enough or whatever to the point where we go, well, of course, you have to somehow invest in open source. But right now, it's like, it's free. We can Jeff you.
So the background for why we're asking Sushila about this is because you were at TypeSafe Lightbend for like a decade, which is a company founded on open source technologies with a business model around them. And so I think you have some insight into open source, how that relates to quality, and then what's the like business lens on that? So that's the background for why we are going into that with you.
I think it's such an excellent question and it's a hard one to answer, which many, many companies have proven over and over again. This is not easy. You know, I think open source is so beautiful in so many ways. And it actually is a technology that kind of it has the same values that I have as a person, like, you know, bringing lots of different ideas and people together to achieve something better than any independent person can do. It's like the levels of innovation and the quality of open source software is astounding. In my whole 9.5 years at TypeSafe/Lightbend, the number of P0s we had, I could count on one hand, and I'm not kidding. It made running a support organization very easy. you go to other technology companies with proprietary software, OMG, the number of P0s, you can count them on one hand, for the day or the month or, you know, it's like, it's astounding the quality difference.
Do you have a sense of like why generally open source has higher quality than,
I'm gonna
than
say proprietary? Care.
Yeah, I think, you know, here's the thing, an open source project, what are really the goals? You want a lot of people to use it. It's solving a technology problem. It's bringing a new idea to the world. It doesn't have the same, the project itself doesn't have commercial goals, right? Mm. And so you can care a lot about the quality and try to be perfect and try to write, you know, the best code possible. You don't have to always be thinking about how can I do this really fast and trade off the fact that this is not going to work for everybody and might go down, but it's good enough. And I think inside a commercial organization, you're making those trade-offs because you are trying to bring innovative features into something that's got to be production ready.
Well, and also you have schedules.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that screws up a lot of things. Oh, yeah. We got to meet this deadline because we made it up.
Right. Well, because we have to hit a revenue target because we have investors and stakeholders and shareholders. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it all starts from there. So I think if you have to be very intentional. Like, are you putting out an open source project, creating an open source project to solve a technical problem? Or are you actually thinking you are going to build a commercial organization around this project? Those are two very different things.
And could I mean, my hope is that we can create a third category, which is somebody who wants to make open source for all the good reasons, but would be able to live off of their efforts. And do you have ideas about how to do that?
I think you have to just, it goes back to being intentional about what you're trying to do with your open source. I'm trying to solve this problem, but I also want to make a living for myself, for 50 engineers, whatever. Like, think about the goal and the outcome you are trying to drive. And that will make it a lot easier to find that fine line between what is going to be freely available and what is going to actually serve a paying market and a paying user. And if you're intentional about that from the get-go, I think you have much higher chances of success than companies who find an open source project that looks really valuable, that has a ton of contributors and a lot of GitHub stars and a lot of users and everyone loves it. And then you try to commercialize it very, very hard. Because if all those other things are true, tons of users, tons of stars, tons of contributors, chances are you've already got everything that someone might pay for freely available. And that's why everyone loves it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I think we're out of time.
Oh my gosh. So, I have loved talking to you.
Oh, yeah, super fun to chat with you. And
really nice.
Thank you for being an amazing person and amazing manager. And for, I guess I hope that our listeners would be inspired to see a picture of what an amazing leader and manager looks like. And if they don't have that,
go find it.
Go find it because, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Find a role model. Yep. And if you don't have a role model where you work, get a different job.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, you guys are engineers. You can change jobs every minute of every day. Not like a
business. That's the illusion anyway.
No, in this market, especially, changing jobs is not easy for anyone right now. So I don't mean to minimize that experience for anybody, but love talking to you. I will come back anytime. Next time, let's talk way more about you guys.
Okay. Well, and maybe you can come to our conference.
Yes.
We'll I was thinking about that. It's only a 4.5-hour drive.
Yeah. Oh, you're close by.
Oh, well, then that makes it easy.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right. Thank you, Sushila. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.